This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, and welcome to Building Sustainability Podcast. I'm your host, Jeffrey Hart, aka Jeffrey the Natural Builder. Building Sustainability consists of conversations with designers, builders, makers, dreamers, and doers, exploring the wide world of sustainability in the built environment by talking to wonderful people who are doing excellent things. Hello and welcome to episode 59 of the Building Sustainability Podcast. This week I'm going to do a super quick intro because the conversations are long. It's a two-parter again this week with Georgie Adams. Georgie is building a house on the back of a van chassis. It is unlike any van conversion you will have ever seen. And before you listen to this episode, I thoroughly recommend that you head over to her Instagram, Building Bluebell, and take a look, because it will make sense of what we are talking about. I met Georgie on the Landscapes of Freedom, Right to Roam protest on the South Downs. And it's fitting because they've just got another protest in the diary, and that is Saturday the 16th of October. So if you are in support of the campaign for Right to Roam, make sure you get down to that. It was a lovely event last time, and I suspect much of the same will happen again. What else is going on? I am just about to head to London at the end of this week to do a nice big plastering job that has been entirely taking up all of my brain space. So apologies that maybe I'm not making any sense. This month we've had a few new Patreon supporters. That is Spoomark, Paul Roost, Anna Ballard, and Amy Charles. Thank you so much to you four. It really, really is fantastic to have you on board. I really appreciate your support. If you would like to join those four, then please head to patreon.com/buildingsustainability. There is a link in the show notes. This is all self-funded, so you know, you guys contributing really helps me pay the bills. It's as simple as that, really. What to tell you about this episode. So yes, two-parter. You're now listening to part one. We had to record over Zoom. Normally use a higher quality audio recorder, but Zoom was the only option. And there are some slightly funny noises. They are quite short-lived and hopefully not too distracting, so apologies for that. There's an F-bomb that I had to beep out. From me, actually. Yeah, I was clearly overexcited about what I was saying. Yeah, it's beeped out. But if you're sensitive to that, Don't listen. And the final thing, just before I set you loose on the episode, is that I really want to create some way of having a conversation around the episodes. I think the input from listeners can be really, really great to sort of continue the discussion. And I think in days gone by, that would naturally have been a Facebook group. But I suspect maybe that people don't really use Facebook like that anymore. Certainly I don't. But yeah, maybe it is Facebook. I don't know. For now, until I've sort of figured it out, if you go to the website, buildingsustainabilitypodcast.com, then you can put a comment on the bottom of every episode. And yeah, maybe if you've got thoughts or comments or concerns or questions, then pop them there for now. And if you've got an idea of how we can have a conversation, then yeah, let me know through the website. Okay, handing you over to Georgie now. The first episode is kind of the nuts and bolts of building Bluebell, her project. It also talks about her project in her hands. And episode two, or the part two, is much more kind of experiences and philosophy. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, as you'll hear. I found it so inspiring, especially because I am, you know, in the depths of a build myself, and there were just such great lessons in there. Yeah, I hope you're all as inspired as I was. Okay, that is it from me. There won't be any outro on the end of this episode. It will roll straight into the next one. Outroed follow on part two. All right, enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, the very original seed of thought was just a van conversion, and then it just got wildly out of control. And this is where I'm at now.
Yeah. And yeah. What was the initial seed?
It's you know, I'm sure as for many, it's quite a layered question. Mm. I mean, I remember, you know, when I was sort of 16, 17 in college and feeling this like deep kind of disconcert feeling about how I was gonna move into just living in the adult world and the housing world, and then I was in London renting and working for a while and just doing the kind of the basic, and really remembered having this like clear feeling of, if I have to just keep doing this and following this system to attempt to get onto the housing ladder, like I think it will kill me. Like I just can't imagine my well-being, my mental health, my passion for life just kind of sustaining itself. It was so hard for me to imagine. So I'd already started thinking about ways of alternative living, and I ended up getting a one-way ticket to New Zealand as the kind of starting point of like, let's figure this out. And I was, you know, very, very fortunate to be able to get the working holiday visa. And while I was over there, I saw some of the really ginormous house trucks, and I remember I was hitchhiking and one just zoomed past me on the road, and I was like, that's it. That's the one, that's the thing. And I ended up going to a few festivals and seeing some of them in person and just kind of thinking, yeah, I can live tiny, no problem. At the time I was also living in a tiny hiker tent that you couldn't even prop up in properly, and I was living in that for the best part of a year, very happily. So actually a van seemed like a huge upgrade. Yeah, so that was where it started. And then I thought to myself, right, so I want to build this structure, but I have zero experience, I've got zero building knowledge, and it all just kind of, yeah, it all just happened by trying to pinpoint some ways of work, like figuring out how I could possibly make something like that to live in. And yeah, it all kind of fell into place, really, with a lot of different life circumstances. I ended up coming back from living overseas, which I was doing for quite some time, and also whilst I was doing that, I was getting a lot of ideas of how to try and live more sustainably, live more simply. That was the main thing, trying to achieve a really simple lifestyle And I'm realizing how happy that made me. And really coming back to those feelings I was having when I was living in London of, you know, what is the correct path to finding that feeling of inner contentment. And for me, it just, yeah, it was simplicity. And so by the time I ended up coming back to England, it didn't feel like such a huge task, because I realized if I just achieve a sense of simplicity, even if it's just a really bog standard box, then I'm going to get there. And then obviously it hasn't turned out into a bog standard box.
No, nor simple.
No, not at all. And that, yeah, that came then from a different, so that was kind of one element of the inspiration for Bluebell. And then there was this whole other section, which was noticing this huge block I was finding to being able to pick up skills and learn kind of construction and engineering principles as a woman. And I had a lot of conversations with people, and I went to quite a few different environments, some building sites with people I knew, and I was getting this really overwhelming feeling of not being able to access it comfortably, not being able to find the skills without feeling I was being a pain or a nuisance, or that it was just a bit cute. You know, it was like a nice try. And a lot of these weren't malicious responses I was getting, but they were really deeply ideological.
Yeah. And well, what sort of places were you looking?
Well, I kind of, when I started going to looking at what kind of vehicle to buy, I went to, with word of mouth, a few different mechanics yards. I went to some, when I was looking for materials, I was going to scrap yards a lot and kind of like talking about what I wanted to do. When I was thinking about the timber, I went to some different timber yards and some different sawmills. And then actually in a workshop space near where I was, where I actually ended up building mine, there was some particular individuals there who made me feel a bit uncomfortable. And all of this seemed really bizarre to me, and also then made me quite pissed off. And so then I was like, right, well, I don't just want to do a Luton. I want to do something that's kind of going to prove a bit of a point, so that if it ever comes up in conversation again, all of the times that I couldn't have anything to back myself up with, now I want to have something that proves a point. And interestingly, as kind of mad as this thing looks, all of the elements of that were actually so simple. So understanding and learning these fundamental construction skills, I just couldn't believe how simple they were actually. Of course, there is elements of practice and research and trial and error.
Yeah, mucking it up a load of times.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, so much. but yeah, the fundamentals were really simple, which then kind of hit a bit of a light bulb for me. And then the more I realized that, the more fearless I kind of got with, well, if I want to build a dome, why not? Like, actually, yeah, why on earth not?
It sounds a little bit like, maybe it's complexity came a little bit as a kind of fuck you to all the people that weren't going to help. Oh,
yeah, that was pretty much it. Yeah. And I think as well, being a little bit stubborn and a little, maybe, I mean, a lot, that helped. That definitely helped. And I also think that's a helpful characteristic if you do want to get into building and construction, because what quite a lot of the times you need to have your vision and your idea, and you have to be pretty stubborn with it, because so often the materials aren't always going to be, you know, working with you, especially because Bluebell was built almost entirely out of off-cycled and waste materials. So usually most of the materials I were working with was bent, warped, you know, it's swollen. The aluminium on the roof was oxidized, so I couldn't heat it up to work with it. You know, most of the time it had to have an element of stubbornness to kind of actually push through that. And and I think that kind of stubbornness came from that initial irritation, and then it kind of channeled through and it continued to push me and then develop actually as a building technique in some ways.
Nice. I guess, well, let's probably go back a little bit actually. So what do you think it was that like drew you to mobile living? What do you, you talked about simplicity.
I think originally when I just sort of packed my bag, I sold most, you know, all of my excess belongings and, you know, the crud that we all just kind of have. And I just was then living out of a backpack. And that was incredibly liberating to have very few things, but have enough that, you know, have enough that I needed to be happy and to be contented. And yeah. And so that was a really amazing revelation to me. Because actually before that, it's quite interesting when I think to how I was as a kid and as a teenager, I was a bit of a hoarder. And I just like my bedroom in London was just the walls were plastered with like photos and sticky notes. And like the floor was full of random things. And yeah. And I've really, that's shifted, not because I'm naturally a minimalist. I'm definitely not. I am a treasure hunter. I think, you know, as many people might relate, I just, you know, I see a stone, I'm like, I must have it and I must place it on the windowsill. So my natural being is to kind of collect pretty things. And yeah, so it definitely actually goes a little bit against my inner self in some ways, but there's that balance, you know, of having enough things that are beautiful but also functional. So yeah, kind of decluttering that element of mobile living. Not everyone actually does that, right? Some people enjoy still having lots of bits and bobs and living small. It doesn't have to be minimal. But for me, that definitely helped me. I think it helped my headspace, helped my anxiety. And so I noticed, you know, in quite a lot of the time when you're exploring these ways of living and you notice the patterns that you might not kind of do them intentionally, but you think, oh, that's making me feel better. So I should probably continue to do that in my life. So yeah. Having less stuff really helped, and that came as part of the parcel for me with mobile living. Another thing, of course, would be that I naturally am quite an introvert and like to be alone, and I'm a bit of a hermit. I enjoy kind of winding down and spending lots of time walking and being in my own thoughts. And I have found that mobile living, even just when I was with my tent and my backpack in some respects, it brought so many people into my life that I wouldn't have necessarily had if it hadn't been for that way of life. Quite often when you're mobile living or you're kind of pursuing more nomadic movements, you often tend to need people and rely on people, and a bit vice versa. There's often this really nice kind of yin and yang of that. I found that with hitchhiking, that quite often you would bump in, you would, you know, get your ride. And actually those people who were offering you the ride maybe really needed that conversation. They needed that chat. And it was, I find that nomadic living and mobile living can really bring you, can bring you to the sense of meeting people and finding like-minded people. And for me, that's always been quite difficult because I'm a bit of an introvert and I don't know how to find the people in my life that I know are synchronized. So being out on the road, living in the van, has brought me a world, a social world that I would be so sad if I didn't have it. And so I think that is really important to me in my life to have those things. And yeah, I'd say maybe the last potentially most important part is that having, you know, the mobile living lifestyle means that typically you are not having to do the extensive working week hours, working for a wage to pay your rent and to pay your bills. And at the end, having very little time left to pursue creative projects, to pursue the people you love and pursue curiosity. You know, I spend so much time just being outside in nature, and that wouldn't be possible if I was having to work so much to pay my bills. And so, yeah, I think trying to find a lifestyle that that brings around a way of life that means that you're actually able to do a lot more of the things that you want to do. And of course, that means that you have to readjust your attitude with what you spend on. So you could quite easily still do a full working week, live in a mobile home of some sort, and still not have much time or money left over. And it all depends on what you spend out on. And, you know, so eating out for me is a massive treat. And yeah, buying certain things, you know, money, it has shifted my relationship with money so much. And yeah, and I really respect its place in my life a lot. Yeah, so I think that actually having that relationship with consumerism and sustainable consumption, you know, like this year, for example, I tried to grow all of my own salad so that I wouldn't have to keep buying salad, which actually costs quite a lot of money. Not that it shouldn't, but it's often, I find it really hard around me to find nice organic or local produce. And it's always, you know, wrapped in all the plastic. So that was, and actually living this lifestyle has meant that I had the time and the energy to do that. I had the mental headspace to do that. And so, yeah, I think all of that really is a massive aid that comes with living mobile.
So you decided that you know, van life was going to fit your way of living or your aims, I guess. So what I've sort of said the next question there, like what do you think as a project, Bluebell, were there sort of some aims in there? We've spoken a little bit about, you know, proving people wrong, perhaps. Was there anything else other than, you know, creating yourself a home?
Yeah, I mean, I think initially at the beginning it was very simply just to create a home, to create a base. And it definitely developed. I think as I was building Bluebell, it inspired conversations with other women who would see the van and they would open up about how much they'd love to be able to use tools and use drills. I think sometimes within the craft world, I've found often it's easy to forget that not everyone has that access to learning and that community around them and that support, and maybe just not even that very initial budge just to be able to pick up the tool and give it a go. And a lot of the people I talk to will just be, you know, your standard people coming out of Sainsbury's, or people who had kind of walked past my workshop because it's past a public footpath. Just friends of mine, family, friends of friends. And the more these conversations started happening, and most interestingly, I found that I rarely actually initiated the conversation. It would be this desire to talk about it and this desire to request, you know, maybe some advice or some help with building. And really the basic thing that people desired was just how to be able to cut wood and drill it together. So that you could achieve basic goals, like putting up a shelf, which I never knew how to do before building Bluebell. There is absolutely no way I would have been able to put up a shelf, which is really ludicrous thinking about it now. And I always remember that sagging feeling of knowing that I'd have to wait or ask a guy. I had no women in my life who would have been able to do that for me. And I'm thinking in cases of social mobility, a lot of people who might be in really poor housing conditions and have landlords that might take a really long time to come and get something fixed. And it could be something so simple as putting a couple pieces of wood together, and then stretching from that very basic desire that people had for those skills, like I said, which ranged all ages, all backgrounds of women. And then it started from that, and then it kind of ranged to people who wanted to learn a little bit more and actually had the curiosity of craft rather than the necessity of making, which I just talked about. It then expanded into the desire to want to work with wood and want to create and want to build, but just having no way in, even just a space, a space and a tool to pick up where you don't feel patronized or you don't feel like, you know, you have to get it right on that first time. I remember when I started building Blue Belt, I could not hit a nail in straight, you know, and so I would sit there with a block of wood with a hammer and I would whack these nails in over and over again until I could get it in straight. And then by the end, I was hitting like these 6-inch nails with a few hits into a block of wood. And that's not because I'm strong or I'm, you know, talented at nail hitting. It's because I had the space and the time. And that was mostly just because I was by myself and that was safe for me to play and to get things wrong without then waiting for someone. I've had situations where tools have been taken off me. I've been told, you know, oh, just let me do that. And the tools have been physically removed from my hands. I had it once at a very well-known timber yard where they would not let me cut the wood I needed off the stack. And then they continued to cut the wood wonky, which I then had to fix. And so it's kind of, you know, having that environment just to be able to learn those basic like wrist movements and something that we all have the ability to do. It doesn't require extra strength. It doesn't require you to be, you know, really a hench and or be like an incredible engineer. It just requires, you know, trial and error, giving it a go. And so I am fortunate enough that I had this space in the countryside, which was a lovely agreement with a farmer. And with my family to kind of, it was basically this like old barnyard, which couldn't be really commercially done much with because it's got an asbestos roof. And it's just this little like nook that's totally open to the elements and the rain, but it was a space. I had this little space just to kind of like hole up in and put some tools in a box. And that enabled me to build my own home. That small little environment. I think an element of that, of people not having the ability to get hands-on with building, is a lot of the time just down to lacking the space and lacking the access to a few basic tools. But then of course what I was seeing was that women were too scared to even enter that kind of that world what's worse, actually, and I know this because I felt this myself, but feel like there's no way that they could achieve those skills because just of what we see in the construction and the building world is, you know, there's not enough representation. And so ideally I really want to see a world where we're not even talking about whether it's a woman building. It's kind of, you know, it's a bugbear even to have to be talking about it, because it should just be genderless. It should just be not remotely weird if a girl is constructing a build. It shouldn't be challenged or questioned. But in order to get there, I think that we just need to get more. We need to get more women using tools, and then it will just become normal. And I think the representation is where I'd like to start. So a really big goal I have is to start an organization, which I have named In Her Hands, which will start off by collecting stories and so films, articles, podcasts, photo sets of women all over the world who are doing building projects. And that could be even as well a bit of plumbing and welding and the rest, but kind of building that vision and that image of women in the construction world, ranging from small projects like mine, building your own home, doing bang conversions, tiny houses, which is a good starting point for me because I've met some amazing women who are making those, but also into architecture and engineering. So that's kind of the conversation and the acceptance and just that image we need to start bringing into a sense of normality. And then ideally my absolute dream would be to have this element of this organization, which could lead to workshops and You know, I can't talk about what it is or isn't yet because it doesn't quite exist yet. But I'm in the real real kind of planning stages of how that could work. And I have a template in mind for a workshop that could be distributed and taught by anyone who has some basic kind of like fundamental building skills. And then maybe creating some physical workshops, some talks and events, but really, yeah, really just initially, even if it gets no further than just creating more of a conversation and an image of women in building and construction, then that's the real kind of goal.
Brilliant. That's fantastic. I can't wait to see what you create. That's really
thank
awesome.
You thanks.
Good. Well, I mean, I guess I want to talk nuts and bolts of, let's talk design and then sort of more techie nerdy things.
Techie nerdy.
Because, I mean, that's what we all want to hear, isn't it? Maybe. That's what I want to hear.
But
I
don't.
Just assume everyone's like me. Design. I mean, had you seen something that you looked at it and went, I want my house to look like that? Or was it a bringing together of styles?
You know what? I don't think I ever saw anything which I thought that's what I wanted to look like. Mm. I knew that I saw the concept and the what it would mean for me in my life, but I didn't see an actual vision. I did have this initial thought, and I actually have the original drawing somewhere that I tore out and thankfully I kept. And it's basically like a front-on view and it looks like a mushroom on wheels. And I had this you know, being someone who spends a lot of time just like out on the ground in the woods, just like on my hands and knees looking at plants and at mushrooms and and being heavily, heavily inspired by the natural world. That was something I thought that would make such a brilliant home, something like that. And I think probably also inspired by fairy tales and books. I'm sure there's some deep folklore going on there. I had this kind of idea to create this organic shape that was round and had no sharp edges. I didn't want any squares going on. And I had this like obsession, which I still do, of old cottages, you know, the kind of big, chunky thatched roofs and those lovely eyebrow windows. And I remember one of the first things that I said to everyone was like, my house is going to have eyebrow windows. And they were like, what are you talking about? You can't like just know. I was like, yes, it will have eyebrow windows and that's final. So I was absolutely convinced I would make eyebrow windows. So I remember like just doing lots of walks, catching the train and like just like doing a lot of walks around old villages and staring at people's houses. Must have looked a bit odd. So that kind of like chunky organic look was what I was going for. However, I had absolutely no plan of how it was going to look or what was going to happen. I was entirely reliant and led on response to materials. So because Bluebell is made almost entirely out of upcycled and recycled materials, I was, of course, really that kind of led me. It didn't limit me. I just had to work within parameters as such. So I knew that my walls, you know, my cladding was going to be wood, and I knew that my roof would have to be metal of some sort. And so I kind of had a very large box to fit into, which I guess is vans are boxes or van homes are boxes for the most part anyway. I just wanted to cut off those angles and make it round. And so that was kind of the main design principle. But like I said, yeah, it was really led by reacting to the materials.
Mm. Oh, fantastic. Did you think about layout early on?
I remember doing a few kind of sketches and doodles, but no, I just kind of, I remember building the, I think all I knew was that my bathroom, my shower was going to be kind of at the very back, which is why I, when I created a little porch for my door, I knew that the kind of the bit on the other side was going to be the shower. And other than that, I had absolutely no idea. I mean, obviously I knew that the bed was going to be on top of the cab. But other than that, nothing, absolutely nothing was originally designed or planned. So when I came to building the framework, deciding where the windows would be, I made a rough idea of where my kitchen might be, because I then had this desire to make this massive churchy window to look out from. And things came step by step. So I then, when I got into the space, I would do a lot of, as I'm sure you must be really, you must resonate with, you just do a lot of standing in your space and just kind of like getting a little like chair and being like, ooh, what about here? What about there? And just like, I did a lot of looking. I'm actually a little bit lazy. So I didn't do like the cardboard cutout, or I didn't put that much effort into any of that. I was just like, it will all come together. It will all happen at some point. And just fingers crossed, it will all work out correct. Which I think it has.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
yeah, I think so.
It looks fantastic. And your eyebrows, four.
Oh, and those eyebrows, four.
So was it, what did you start with in terms of vehicle?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hey there, I'm Mick from the Mick and Pat Show.
That's right, and I'm Pat.
Looking for a podcast that's like catching up with old friends? Well, you're in luck.
We're here to bring you weekly doses of lifestyle commentary, discuss culture and politics, and top it off with the occasional beer and film reviews.
But it's not just about us. We're a community. Our listeners are our kin, and we let you all have a say in what we discuss.
So saddle up and join the conversation at the Mick and Pat Show. You can check out our website or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes, I search, really difficult to get chassis cabs in the south of England that are just like the actual skeletal frame. Mm-hmm. It took me a long, really long time. I almost, believe it or not, gave up on the entire project because I just couldn't, within my price range, which was sort of my absolute maximum budget was 5,000 for the vehicle. And then I was kind of looking for something in between 2 and 3. That's what I had saved up all beforehand with work. And I ended up going right to the max of my budget. I think it was like £4,900 for the chassis. And it's an Iveco daily. I think it's a medium wheelbase. It's not actually a long wheelbase. It's medium. And it, yeah, just came with the two, I don't know what you call them, like beams, which hold the wheels on.
Yeah, I don't know.
My terminology is shocking. Yeah, the little beamy things, which hold the wheels, the little sticks. And that was it. So it was just kind of like the skeleton of the vehicle.
Yeah. Because your design is sort of Luton-ish in terms of, mm-hmm. I mean, I think of that because of the sort of cab. Above, or the space above the cab. Yeah, so how did you go from chassis with the sticky bits, official terminology now, to sort of where you had a defined shape?
So I went to a local metal fabricator, and I bought some angle iron and box section. And I kind of had like a rough idea. I did a lot of staring at the underbellies of like Arctic lorries and like just googling. My Google search history must have been quite bizarre. Like, what does the underbelly of an Arctic lorry look like?
I can't imagine you were getting advertised after that.
Yeah, you tell me. It was lots of weird kind of like looking, because I think that's really how I actually didn't read any books. I did again, it's like my lazy part coming out of me. I did a lot of looking. So I just looked at vans. I looked underneath Luton's, you know, in supermarkets when no one's looking, just like shoving my head underneath, and could see the basic way that a chassis cab, because most chassis cabs come as chassis with the bare structural work, and then they have the things attached to the back, whether that's a flatbed or the tippers or the lutens. And most of them will work on the same kind of basic. You've got a steel frame, so it's just a rectangle with some bits going across, I figured. And so I went to the fabricators and I got some angle iron and box section from them, and they very kindly gave me some offcuts and gave me some offcuts of some aluminium box section, which goes across the top of the cab, so that keeps that nice and light. That whole kind of the floating bedroom is all actually quite lightweight, and because I figured it would need to work on a cantilever because it couldn't be touching the cab, I didn't want it resting on the cab at all. That worked out really well. And then I went to the scrapyard and I found all this old supermarket cladding, which is metal, like tin steel, very thin. I think it's like, it's not super thin. It's a millimeter thick, mm-hmm. I believe. And it has then like a plastic kind of like sticker coating, which would have faced the exterior of the supermarket, and it just came in these massive sheets, and I was like, perfect, that can make the underside, basically all of the underside of the framework, so that goes all at the bottom and up the back. So I found all of that cladding, and so then I kind of had that basic metal frame just at the very bottom. That was quite interesting, actually, because I had no concept of engineering, just sensation and kind of, you know, shutting my eyes and kind of imagining where stress points would be. If I was to turn a corner, where would the stress be? And kind of just like moving my body and like imagining where the weight would be distributed. So, I'd then be like, right, a bolt needs to go there, I guess. And that's kind of how it all worked when I figured out the engineering element. And and so after I'd got that kind of metal element sorted at the very bottom,
is it welded?
No, because I don't have welding skills, and just on a tiny side note, I'm very excitingly starting a college class an evening class for 10 weeks on welding, which I'm like, I'm brilliant. So excited about. I can't even exclaim how excited.
Oh, I'm a little bit jealous.
Yeah, I tell you what, with building Blue Belt, all the tiny little niblets that you need to make, like just like kind of tinsy little brackets. And I, you know, often I'm just like, what a skill welding would be. It would have made my life so much easier rather than having to kind of like trawl through the internet and lots of trips to fabricators to see if they could just make this tiny thing. That's exciting. But no, it's not welded. I did everything with bolts, just bolted everything together. And I needed quite specific bolts. So I actually ended up buying just threaded bar and the specific nuts and washers and kind of making my own bolts. Worked out way cheaper. And I also found a lot of things secondhand and upcycled. And most of my washers were all upcycled. I think it was mainly just the threaded bar that I bought. So that was all, it's all bolts. So actually I think Blue Bell's only held on by 12 bolts. And if I undo them, I could take the whole thing off and put it somewhere else. Yeah. So it's not reliant on the vehicle.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you don't want the vehicle engine to die. And then you're like, oh, got to start again.
Yeah.
Or I'm tied to this, you know, potentially defective, you know, engine part.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I thought that was quite important. That's how that started, just that basic kind of ground level. And then I went up all with timber, everything else apart from the roof, and obviously ancillaries, screws, which for the first 2 years of the build were almost all like waste screws, actually, the ones that didn't like kind of, you know, the last few in the box for someone else. And I just ended up getting these bucket loads of mixed screws, and then all evening I'd like separate them out and that would be my screw. So I saved a lot of money on ancillaries by being able to get them secondhand and just upcycling them. And so it all went up with timber, which was mostly offcuts. It's actually only 2x1, my framework.
Okay.
So very, very thin. I was pretty confident about that. and hasn't let me down thus far. So the actual framework then is very lightweight. So that's just 2x1. And then there's cedar cladding on the outside. And that's kind of like the outer walls, cedar cladding. And then it goes up into an aluminium roof. Just let me know if there's anything I'm scooching past or you want me to clarify on. But the roof is then aluminium, which was also an amazing secondhand find. I kind of built this roof shape, and there was this tiny voice in the back of my mind, which was like, Georgie, you should probably think about how you're going to clad this ridiculous roof shape you're making, because materials, like most nice materials, you know, that aren't, you know, plastic, are not going to want to form over this shape with bumps and lumps and eyebrows. I think there's three eyebrows. One is actually the porch, the bathroom window, and then the kitchen window. And that's not actually even talking about the dome, which is just all like a continuous wibbly wobbly eyebrow. And so it was this niggling voice in my head like, ooh, this is naughty, this is going to be really hard to clad. And then I got to the situation where I was like, right, I need my roof material. So actually, funny enough, I've kind of I've gone back on myself, because actually I said I was responsive to the materials, but the roof was actually the roof shape was one where I was like, I have this vision and the materials are going to work for me this time. I am going to make it work no matter what. So I ended up going to so many scrap yards and like not really finding anything that was lightweight enough. I couldn't use the supermarket cladding, so it was just too heavy. And I was kind of getting to a bit of a state where I was like, oh no, have I just done myself in and I have to use something like fiberglass, which I really don't want to have to do. But I was like persistent. So I continued the search. And I really, really, that entire kind of ethos of Bluebell is to use upcycled and secondhand materials. So I ended up finding this tiny little rural scrapyard where right at the top, he had these loads of these old trays of aluminium. Well, they came from a garden center and they were what you put your seedlings in, like when they're first potted into little pots. And so there are these trays and they're about, I think they're about 50 by 90 or something, 50 centimeters right. by 90 centimeters, something like that. And I took them all. I was like, that's it. It's aluminium. That's perfect. It's going to be light. It's going to be malleable. I was all there. Also, this tiny voice in the back of my head, like, how are you going to do that on those eyebrows? But I was like super happy. And yeah, that ended up taking that roof was horrifying. It was so hard. It was so hard to do because I did it over the winter and I don't have an internal space. It's all outside. And metal doesn't like being worked when it's cold, and oxidized metal that you can't heat up also doesn't really like working when it's cold. I was trying to avoid the brittle parts to not make holes in it, for example. And so the whole thing took me 6 months to do.
Wow.
I just hand beated the whole thing. Sometimes a single tray, I think I've got 50 trays on the roof, and just over 50 trays. And another cute side fact is that I used every single tray. One went wrong and it split, but I used every single tray and that was exactly the amount I needed.
Wow.
So if I'd had one too little, I would have had to, it would have been one too little, and I would have had to have bought some new aluminium, and it would have looked, you know, it would have looked very different to the way this old aged aluminium looks. So that was really funky. But yeah, I had to hand beat it. And some of the pieces, like around the eyebrows, those eyebrows, took 2 days just to get the, you know, like a tiny little shape would kind of just take 2 days of whacking it. So that was a massive project. But all, like I said, it all kind of all very much responsive. Because by the time I actually had the aluminium, I was learning a lot. I was learning so much about metal, just working with it, just feeling it. And this is something that I really believe in. I think that if you start working with the materials, even if you've got no clue, even if you've had no experience, you don't know how to use the tools, if you just start with the material talks to you. And in the case of cold metal, it shouts at you. and so I really learned quite quickly. And it's actually, I think even though making that roof was one of the most horrid things I've ever had to do, it's now inspired this deep love of metal, which is quite interesting. That's the roof.
Fantastic. I mean, it's probably the thing that people are going to see the first. Like it's the thing that stands out as, wow, that's not a thing you see in a van. And I love knowing the story about it. How much did your 50 seed trays cost you, do you remember?
Well, they were £5 a sheet,
right? So 250 quid for
that's
is that good
for
maths?
That roof,
yeah.
That's it. Yep, £250. Every time I do this calculation in front of someone, I have to pause.
Okay, good.
Like, is that correct? But yes, that's right, I believe. But so it would have cost, 250 quid. So it was pretty cheap for an aluminium roof, really.
Yeah. I mean, as long as you don't charge a day rate for your time.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I like dread to think. In some cases, I'm like, I could have just like stayed in, you know, some kind of like fancy job. I mean, not that I ever had a fancy job, but you know, and I could have, if I was to actually just have worked and saved the money, you know, it's a totally different mindset. But really, the amount of labor hours that have gone on this have been, have been pretty high. But that is, you know, I quite often would get into this bit of a spiral of thinking, you know, the old anxiety kicking in and thinking how long it had taken me and is still taking me, and getting myself in a bit of a tizzle about all of that and think sometimes feeling a bit guilty or a bit like, you know, a little bit uncomfortable about that, and about my ability, and thinking, well, if everyone had the time I had, anyone could, you know, anyone could do it, which actually I do believe as well. But I kind of did get into a bit of this headspace of feeling a bit uncomfortable about things just taking so long. And then I really rephrased it and realized that, you know, I didn't get any training, I didn't go to school, I have no one telling me how to use these tools or how to do this stuff. And so actually I never went to university either, so I'm kind of imagining, you know, these 3 years out of my life that it's taking to do this, that is my university, that this is my learning time. I've kind of been at school this whole time, and it's been totally joyous. But it really, it's also removing yourself from that fast-paced industrialized concept of your time and work and like this high-paced fast action that's totally unsustainable in the real world, in the working world, and also as an individual, and trying to remove yourself from that and realizing, you know, just you don't need to take it all so seriously. I take Bluebell not seriously at all now. There were definitely times when I was taking it way too seriously, but I've calmed down a bit now.
What a unbelievable journey. It's such a joy. I honestly can't believe that you have had no sort of, you know, formal training, because the thing you've created is, well, I should say you are creating, because it's not done yet, is it?
No, not quite yet. Yeah, there's the kind of main building, most of the building's finished. I just this weekend put in the wood burning stove.
Oh yes, I just saw on Instagram the lighting of the stove.
Yep, very exciting stuff. I've got, really, it's just now like the fundamentals. So I have to install, so my bathroom, I'm very excited to say I'm going to work with my dad, who's a brilliant, he is a wonderful painter. He does beautiful paintings. That's not his job, but he just loves doing it. And it should be his job. He's so very good at it. And we're going to do a bathroom impressionist mural of the South Downs where I live.
Oh, nice.
All covered in snow. And so like the whole bathroom is going to be kind of like a mural, and it's going to lead on to, which I think you might find interesting, Jeffrey, my walls I have devised a kind of a recipe, let's say. I have always been obsessed with the cottages, and one of those main inspirations was the bumpy plaster walls that meet the old beams and, you know, give you vibes of Wind in the Willows and, you know, The Hobbit, and just that feeling, you know, those beautiful old materials, basically old, natural, wholesome materials that, you know, just growing up in a normal modern kind of building framework, you didn't have. And I always remember being absolutely obsessed with them as a kid, with those bumpy walls. And so that's something that I really wanted to do in here. But of course, plaster cracks. And so how are you going to do that in a vibrating, bumpy, you know, moving house, especially because also the wall, because it's all made out of wood and it's breathable, that the walls move. Sometimes I'm taking measurements and I can't believe how out of square something's got just through the movement. And which, of course, actually is relevant, because that's the old cottages all moved mad and are all wonky. But yeah, basically, I've devised a bit of a recipe that, if it all goes to plan, I will release. It's nothing clever at all. But I am making a kind of vibration-proof plaster mix that I'm gonna put all on my walls. So that it meets all the beams and these old, because all of these old strips of wood that cover all of the windows run upside the wall. And I've kind of covered all of the, because a lot of my woodwork that I've made things with was offcuts of stuff from like covers, and so it was all just had that like kind of just doesn't particularly look very pretty. So I had these old beams that I believe I were told were 800 years old. And I sliced off, I took a long time just setting up a jig and slicing off the aged front of the beam into very, very thin strips so that it would remain lightweight, but it would give the appearance of looking really old. So I have all these old bits of beams and wood, you know, framing all my doors and my windows. And I'm hoping that the plaster will kind of meet that. And I'm going to get this old cottage feeling here. So that's going to be one of the last main kind of big projects after sort of doing, I need to focus at the moment on the important things like setting my tap in and getting my water system working and my shower. I've got a working compost toilet and the wood burner. So I'm pretty sure that's most of the things that I need for winter now, but I'm going to put a big effort into finishing it all off pretty soon, I think.
Brilliant. I mean, speaking of winter, what's your insulation?
My insulation, this is one of the bugbears. Unfortunately, it's not got the best rep. It's all skip found Celotex. Because it had the ethos of being upcycled. It's the amount of that stuff which is just lying around, you know, is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. There is so much waste Celotex going, and it's not a nice, it's, yeah, as many who may listen to this may know, it's not the best material. And if I was building a house from scratch or doing this again, I may have thought differently about it, but it was the ethos of still using reclaimed materials. And so it's mostly done all with, or it's pretty much all recycled Celotex. Yeah.
Nice. And what's, you've got something over the top of it. Looks like,
oh, this stuff.
Yeah, these, what's that?
Well, I actually, so my I've always been a bit skeptical that my plaster mix isn't going to work. Okay. there's still a risk. So underneath this is actually some ply, just really thin ply,
right?
That I was able to wangle, and is that a word? Wangle, I think. Yeah. So
wrangle,
let's make it wangle.
I prefer wangle.
Sounds
wangle
much better.
So you wangled some ply.
I wangled some ply, and then I thought if the plaster goes horrifically wrong, then I can take this top layer off and it will just be a wall underneath that I can still use and just paint, you know. So I have a bit of a fail safe if all goes wrong. But this is reclaimed hardboard.
Nice.
So it's just thin reclaimed hardboard. And for some of it, I was in it's for the stuff in the bathroom, because the bathroom's also a bit of a experiment, because I've used marine ply, because, you know, I'm creating, I'm hoping that the oil paint is going to provide like a natural barrier for the shower and the water. But the part that isn't in the shower cubicle is actually also hardboard, but I was able to get some, formaldehyde free. I was able to get formaldehyde free hardboard, which I, with a bit of research, I found is better with water absorbency. It's much better to get a formaldehyde free board in those kind of environments.
Yeah.
Apparently, according to my research, which was quite a while ago, and I'm hoping is still relevant and correct. Disclaimer. So yeah, this is all hardboard, but will be covered with my plaster experiment.
Magic plaster mix. Yeah. I'm excited. I thought long and hard about, like, can I make my walls? You know, can I plaster them? I thought for a long time in the tiny house, like, can I put an earth floor in? Is that possible? I mean, I should. That's sort of my thing. But yes, weight calculations were the thing that stopped me. So
yeah.
That leads me nicely onto asking you about weight. How conscious have you been of it with your metal roof?
I tell you what, I was building blind the entire time. I did that thing of being like, okay, every material I put in, I will weigh. But as I've mentioned, I can be a tad on the lazy side. So I was just like, you know, nah. No. So I was building blind for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I took it to the weighbridge when I had all the roof on. I had the insulation in, I think. Yeah, it was just, so all the metal was on, all the insulation was in, and so the whole framework came to quite a fair bit less than a Luton body stripped would have come. So I was in good, that was a sigh of relief. We went in, I went with my dad and my aunt, and we all took predictions as to what it was going to be. And it came out on the lowest, which was good. So I think, I can't remember, I'm trying to think now, but I believe it came to like two. So it's a 3.5 ton weight limit, 3,500 kilograms. And it came to something like 2900 or something. It came a fair amount under. And then I weighed it again last winter, when I had all my walls in, I had my battery in, I had my kitchen counter in, I had all my internal cladding in, and that came to 3,150. So that left me with 350 kilograms left over. Yeah. So that was for the solar panels, the wood burner, and then of course like water and food and a bit like some extra bits and bobs, the shower unit. So funny you mention it, I do need to now I put the wood burner in, I need to make a trip. And I'm hoping that it's still, I made a calculation when I last took it to the weighbridge that with all those things added in, I knew the weight of my solar panels. And fortunately, I made my framework for my solar panels myself.
I noticed, I watched your there was a brilliant video where you were going, well, I could do it the easy way that wouldn't look very good, or I can do it the way that I'm going to do it, which is going to be ludicrous and take loads of time, but look great.
Yeah, that was it. It was basically like, I didn't want to, the curve of the roof, obviously, I've got these quite big flat panels. So I've not gone for the curved sticky type. I've gone for like normal, good quality solar mm-hmm. panels, which so all in all I've got 550 watts of solar.
Nice.
I think, yeah, so kind of a hopefully enough to get me through an English winter, given that I use very little mm-hmm. apart from when I need to charge my camera equipment. So yeah, I have these two big panels on the top, and I was able to get some offcuts of gazebo aluminium, which is, you know, little, they're quite small pieces of box section. So super, super lightweight. I could pick everything up just with one hand that went on the roof for the framework. And yeah, and I kind of just installed this system that meant that it wouldn't be a rack. It wouldn't be raised up. and therefore create this big detraction from the roof. It's actually all works within the shape of the roof. So it's still a square frame, but it works with the curve and it doesn't actually raise the panels up at all. They still sit partly on the roof. But that actually came in less than my prediction. So hopefully I made the calculation when I last went to the weighbridge and fingers crossed I stay in underweight. But oh yeah.
Have you got a contingency for if you have gone over?
Someone once told me that they went through a bunch of their like woodworks, so some of their cladding and like some of the chunkier pieces, and they went with a router and they just like carved they just like carved out loads of the wood and said it literally brought them underweight. I don't quite think that goes against my laziness. I don't quite think I'd be into doing that. I think the likelihood is so I know for sure that I have space from my calculations. I've definitely got space going on. I might just have to rethink my water storage. And I wanted originally, I have calculated enough space to have a huge reservoir tank. So I don't want my plumbing all to go into one tank. I kind of just want this tank that has a little tap on the outside, and I want to have a small tank on the inside, just to have multiple options so that I can always, I can always empty the tank, the big tank, but still have a little tank in the middle. It's just a bit more flexible. But I had this idea of having this lovely big reservoir. but I think then if I have to backstep on something, it will need to be that. And I have also calculated to have a storage box underneath that may have to go. So there are contingency plans that don't mean ripping apart something on the inside. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Cause I mean, water is heavy. It is.
Yeah.
It's very heavy.
Yeah. I also, I've also planned for this big gas tank. One of the ones that is on the bottom is fixed underneath an underslung gas tank, and they are big and also of course heavy, so it may just have to be that I go for your standard ones that you take in and refill, which to be fair I have now in the little space I live in and is absolutely fine. I just like the idea of if I go to Europe, I think it's, you know, being able to refill for a longer amount of time, or if you really want to be off grid for a solid amount of time, you don't then have to kind of drive in and replace it. It's not the end of the world, however, if I do have to go to that.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.